with the opposition's Yusuf Raza Gilani receiving 42. Despite a relatively robust standing in domestic affairs of Pakistan, the fact that the United Arab Emirates has moved to withdraw financial support of Islamabad indicates a widening gap in their bilateral relations. Pakistan doesn't seem to have the money to give back. Therefore, even the prospects of losing such a loaded friend has the ability to induce panic in Pakistan's politics.
Last year, when Saudi Arabia announced a similar demand, Pakistan's all-weather friend China came to Imran Khan's rescue. Thanks to Beijing's handsome help, Pakistan paid back $1 billion out of the $3 billion loan that it had secured back in 2019 to avoid default. Now, many expect China to do another trick and get Pakistan to safe shores again. But why lend money to someone when you're sure of their inability to pay back?
Pakistan's economy is severely dependent on international support. This is why the country is deep in debt with almost no real possibility of payback. The financial assistance packages by Saudi Arabia and the UAE helped Pakistan to buy time to negotiate a deal with the International Monetary Fund, or the IMF. But the implementation of the IMF deal has been itself in limbo for over a year now.
Unfortunately, IMF has totally gripped the economy of Pakistan, and the country, Ministry of Finance and all the financial institutions are acting completely what the IMF want, because they have, I many times said this, that the IMF have first planted their people. They have given the positions in the current government. There are the key elements and the key figure of the Imran Khan government are the people who were the employees of the IMF previously. So right now, so it's mean that the country economy has been hijacked by IMF. And currently, the situation is getting worse and worse. And if the situation goes on, I think that the country is going towards some sort of the major bankruptcy.
Pakistan returned the Saudi loan by securing three different financing pipelines from China. Beijing gave Islamabad $1 billion as soft loan, a credit swap financing line of $1.5 billion and $500 million commercial loan from the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China. The Chinese assistance helped the State Bank of Pakistan maintain the gross foreign exchange reserves of around $13 billion. Currently, the Pakistani government is trying its best to revive the stalled IMF bailout program. As part of the IMF conditions, the government is amending clauses in the State Bank of Pakistan Act of 1956 on the definitions of the monetary liabilities of the central bank.
The IMF has a plan that how to suck the blood of the people, and how they will take all its control into the institutions, because this is a strategy. When IMF want to cripple the economy of any country, or they want to put the country towards a bankruptcy, they use such kind of the tactics. So similarly, if I will give you an example that how what's going on in Lebanon now, that their economy is moving towards the barter system. So that is horrible and alarming. So we can see the similar situation is going in Pakistan, because the major sectors of the economy who were the source and the revenue generation sources, they have almost finished. So in that condition, Pakistan economy has been handicapped by IMF by planting their own people into the Pakistani government.
A rollover may be able to postpone Islamabad's problem for some time, but the media frenzy over the UAE move was indicative of Pakistan's strategic significance in the geopolitical alignments of Asia and the entire world. Saudi and UAE pressure is pushing Pakistan towards China, as well as perhaps Iran and Turkey, something the United States and probably India never like. On the other hand, Washington needs Islamabad to keep its foothold in Afghanistan, which is itself getting closer and closer to China. Pakistan is a centerpiece in many of the regional puzzles that we have today.
The network of political alignments around Pakistan is complex, and any slight shifts can lead to big consequences. The recent row over the return of UAE's loan further proved the case. Pakistan is among the rare countries in the world with cordial ties with both China and the US. Washington needs it for better reach in Afghanistan, and Beijing needs it for access to the Indian Ocean. It is a good partner to its western neighbor, Iran, but has a history of adversary against India, which in turn has historically friendly connections with Iran. Saudi Arabia and Iran can't get along together, but both value their relations with Pakistan. It does not seem to be about the money. By playing the money card, the UAE may be just mimicking Saudi gimmicks to threaten the government, force Pakistan into Israeli ties, or whatever manipulation they deem favorable. But no matter their objectives, unexpected changes in dynamic systems don't necessarily lead to favorable results.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to learn more about this, we are joined by Mr. Kamar Cheema. He's a strategic and political analyst. Mr. Cheema, welcome to this show. So, why has the UAE demanded repayment of its $1 billion loan back from the debt-ridden Pakistan? What does Abu Dhabi want to achieve other than its money?
Well, the United Arab Emirates and the Saudi Arabia has demanded the money back. The reason behind is that when they gave the money, obviously Pakistan was not thinking that there could be other things which the Emiratis and the Saudis may ask. And while Pakistan had to lose the financial autonomy was no more with Pakistan, so the Saudis and the Emiratis want to take away our autonomy regarding the foreign policy choices. So what we have learned through the sources is that the Pakistan has been asked to recognize Israel. So while the Pakistani government has decided not to recognize Israel because Pakistan's founding father, Qaeda Azam Muhammad Ali Jinnah, has made it clear long ago that we cannot recognize Israel and until and unless there is a two-state solution for that. So that was the reason that the Emiratis are trying to pressurize Pakistan, and it's just not the $1 billion which the Emiratis are demanding. The other challenge is that the visas have been banned for the Pakistanis. So the Pakistanis are unable to secure the position in UAE, which the other countries can secure. So this is a kind of a challenge that Pakistan had to face by not recognizing Israel. And we had to lose our foreign policy choices. We have been asked to compromise our foreign policy choices because of this.
Wow, really, something really astonishing. So you talked about Israel, of course, but is Abu Dhabi's move somewhere around removing Imran Khan from power, and will he survive such a political upheaval? What are his options?
Well, Abu Dhabi really doesn't want to remove Imran Khan from the power. He doesn't want this, and they will not try to micromanage in Pakistan's politics. They have not been doing it even in the past. But primarily, the choices for Imran Khan has reduced because when Imran Khan came in power, he had to go to the UAE and to the Saudi Arabia for asking money for the financial challenges we were facing. So, and that was the reason that even the International Monetary Fund gave money to Pakistan, that the Saudis and Emiratis were providing us some of the financial bailout plan. So they don't want Imran Khan to come go out of the power, but definitely they want that we should compromise on our foreign policy. For example, Pakistan didn't go to Malaysia when there was a session that was called by Mahathir Mohamad, the former Prime Minister of the Malaysia, to have a session parallel than the OIC. And at the same time, Pakistan has been asked to, that Pakistan is asking the Emiratis and the Saudis to call a special session of the foreign ministers of the Muslim countries so that they can talk on Kashmir. But unfortunately, calling that particular session, we have been facing challenges, and that challenges are that we have been asked to not to rely or not to depend on any kind of foreign policy bailout from the Emiratis and the Saudis.
Mr. Jima, our team has collected a few global media coverages in this regard, and I would appreciate if you could just take a look, and then we can continue. Thanks.
Earlier this year, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and Pakistan reached a staff-level agreement to release $500 million US dollars as part of the larger loan pact. The year 2019 saw the international financial institution agreeing to provide a $6 billion US dollar loan to the country to rein in the debt crisis in exchange for reform measures. The Pakistani currency hit over a one-year high at 156.99 rupees against the US dollar in the interbank market in mid-March, as flow of foreign currencies remained high compared to outflows. The inflows have kept the currency's foreign currency reserve stable at a 13-month high of $13 billion and strengthened Islamabad's capacity to make international payments mainly on import and foreign debt repayment counters. The analyst said the latest recovery in rupee was partially backed by the reports that the UAE would roll over soft loan worth $1 billion to Pakistan. Islamabad was scheduled to pay off the loan last Friday, March 12th, but the transaction did not take place. Pakistan has found itself in stronger standing with the Saudi-led bloc of Arab nations, having managed to mend a rift while maintaining ties with another alliance with Iran and Turkey that is challenging the Saudis' leadership of the Muslim world. After the Pakistan-Arab League rift emerged in August, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates asked Pakistan to repay $4 billion in loans taken out in 2018. Then in December, the UAE suspended the issuance of work visas to Pakistani nationals, a move experts said was designed to pressure Pakistan. Out of the committed $6.2 billion, the UAE dispersed $2 billion. It did not make the $3.2 billion oil financing facility and also withheld last $1 billion cash disbursements. Finance Ministry sources had told the Express Tribune that less disbursements by the UAE as against the commitments were because of Pakistan's decision to avail $500 million cash support from Qatar. The UAE has already rolled over $1 billion deposit for another year, which matured in January this year. Despite the drop in global remittances, two of the world's largest recipients of remittances, Pakistan and Bangladesh, registered a rise in flows in 2020 compared with 2019. Pakistanis working abroad sent home more than $2 billion for the eighth consecutive month in January 2021, with Saudi Arabia and the UAE emerging as the biggest contributors to the remittance inflows in recent months. UAE-Pakistan remittances in January 2021 was recorded at $2.3 billion, up by 19% from a year earlier, the country's central bank said. Pakistanis living and working in Saudi Arabia and the UAE contributed the highest inflows during from July 2020 to January 2021, amounting to $7.9 billion in total. A Saudi group that had originally bought the Karachi Electricity Supply Corporation, now called K-Electric, in 2005, has re-entered the scene amid an impasse over the future of the power utilities business relations with the government following the downfall of Arif Naqvi, the British-Pakistani businessman who was the founder and chief executive of the Dubai-based private equity firm, the Abraj Group. The owner of the Al Jomei Holding Company of Saudi Arabia, Sheikh Abdul Aziz Hamid Al Jomei, spent the day on separate meetings with President Arif Alvi, Prime Minister Imran Khan, Ministers for Finance, Energy and Privatization, and some other important stakeholders.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Chima. So, moving ahead, what are the economic and political consequences of removing such a huge amount from the Pakistani economy?
Well, first of all, it will have a direct impact on the foreign exchange reserve, which is very less at the moment. I think around $14 billion foreign exchange reserves are with the central bank. This is the first economic challenge we will face. Definitely, it will have a challenge for any foreign direct investment because if there is no money in the central bank, all the FDI, they keep on looking the macroeconomic indicators, and the government of Pakistan is trying to keep the macroeconomic indicators in a good position so that they can attract the foreign investors. So this is one thing which is definitely going to be a challenge when it comes to economics. But politically, it will have the impact that Pakistan's Kashmir policy has got weakened because Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and particularly the Saudis and the Emiratis, they are not supporting Pakistan on this particular issue of Kashmir. And since they believe that Pakistan is not taking care of their choices regarding recognizing Israel or making or having a starting a debate in Pakistan about the recognition of Israel, so why to listen to Pakistan on that? And above all, the Emiratis, we have been asked, not by anyone, but we have been asked by some of the quarters in the Middle East that we should not be as neutral as we are when it comes to Iran as well. So particularly, I believe that Pakistan's political choices will further be compromised because Pakistan wants to keep a position of neutrality in Middle East, particularly in the Saudi-Iran impasse.
Okay, Mr. Chima, the UAE's call happened only after a few months after a similar measure by Saudi Arabia. Are they connected?
Well, it seems that that there is some kind of a connection between the Emiratis and the Saudis on this, because personally, I find that the Saudis were not happy when Pakistan took a stance that Pakistan is not going to recognize Israel. So, and at the same time, we were not supporting the Emiratis and the Saudis on when they waged a war in Yemen. And Pakistan's parliament decided that we are not going to send the troops in Yemen and there will not be any boots on the ground. So this was a very turning point where the Emiratis were not very much happy on this. And somehow the GCC and these Arab countries, they try to have a unified policy on Pakistan because Pakistan talks to all of these for a support on Kashmir issues. So, and we wanted a collective support from the platforms like Organization of Islamic Cooperation and from the GCC, but unfortunately we couldn't. So there is some kind of a unity between the Saudis and the Emiratis.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chima. Unfortunately, it marks the end of our show. And thank you for your very commendable comments. People have voiced their opinion on social media and cyberspace. And let's just take a quick look.
Faisal Ali Shah said on his Twitter post, "Very challenging situation for Pakistan. UAE demands loan back at the same time as defense and others deal with agreements signed between Israel and UAE. Keep in mind, Pakistan is under pressure also to join Arab-Israel alliance against Iran." Mayank Jindal believes that UAE announces $10 billion fund for investments in Israel after a phone call between Mohammed bin Zayed and Netanyahu. Zayed says $1 billion will come from Pakistan as loan reimbursement and $9 billion will be scheduled investments. Tarun Khanna reacts on his Twitter account and says, "I wonder who will help Imran Khan to pay back the loans and which territory of Pak will be kept at stake." Mansi believes that UAE is behaving like an old Hindi film zamindar, who just wants to have the poor farmer's land and house in return for the loan the farmer took from them. Muslim Brotherhood is dead, it seems. Poor Pakistan.
And that was our episode about the aftershocks of the UAE request for repayment of its big loan from Pakistan and the political dynamics of economic ties between Abu Dhabi and Islamabad. We shall meet next week.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي.
What non-Muslims say about Ali, the first successor of Prophet Muhammad? Wilfred Madelong, professor of Arabic at Oxford University, says the following about Imam Ali in his book, The Succession to Muhammad, A Study of the Early Caliphate, pages 309 to 310. In face of the fake Umayyad claim to legitimate sovereignty in Islam as God's vicegerents on earth, and in view of Umayyad treachery, arbitrary and divisive government, and vindictive retribution, they came to appreciate his honesty, his unbending devotion to the reign of Islam, his deep personal loyalties, his equal treatment of all his supporters, and his generosity in forgiving his defeated enemies.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. One of the great lessons which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali is this concept of living a very simple and humble lifestyle to the extent where even our food is simple and humble. So we find in one of the traditions in the historical texts that a person by the name of Suwaid bin Ghafla reports, "I went to see Imam Ali alayhi salam while he was in the seat of the Khilafah, the Caliphate," meaning he was the Caliphate at the time. He says, "I went and I saw that before the Imam there was a bowl of sour yogurt, the smell of which I could even feel. And there was a loaf of bread of barley, the husk of which I could see was in his hands. The Imam was breaking the dry bread with his hand, and when the bread was too hard to be broken by the hand, Imam Ali would break the bread with his knee and then dip it inside the yogurt." He says, "Imam Ali asked me to approach him and share with him the food. I apologized and said that I am fasting." Dear friends, it is so interesting when we compare this universal persona of Imam Ali as far as the simplicity of lifestyle, the simplicity of food. And on the other hand, again, when we compare it to the leaders of the present day and the extravagance in which they live and the extravagant clothes and the extravagant lifestyle and the delicacies and foods which they eat, we really find it refreshing to see how Imam Ali, a true leader, lived, eating sour yogurt, and that too just a small bowl, and barley bread, which was hard and tough to eat. And even then we find that Imam Ali was willing to share his food with others. Truly, is this not a profound lesson for our age? A lesson which deals with the simplicity of life, the simplicity of bread, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection on the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعض الظالم على يدي يقول يا ليتني اتخذت مع الرسول سبيلا.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger. Protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. Ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi talks about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir la'inir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. And I'd like to begin with this very question about Amir al-Mu'mineen. And the question about who is Ali is actually a very simple question. What I want to answer tonight is the question of what is Ali. There is a difference between who is Ali and what is Ali. To further explain that, let me quote to you a hadith narrated by Imam Ahmad al-Nisa'i and Muhibbuddin al-Tabari. These are all Sunni authors and scholars of high status. They have a narration from somebody by the name of Abu Sa'id al-Khudari, a very prominent companion of the Prophet, respected by us also. And he says that one day we were sitting waiting for the Prophet in the courtyard of Masjid al-Nabi. The house of the Prophet and the Masjid were all, you know, close to one another. Then he says, we saw the Prophet coming out of his house, holding his slippers or his sandals. And one of the sandals, you know, the strap was broken. And so he first looks at Ali, goes to him and gives him, and he says, you know, repair this for me. And then he sat down. And he says to them, Inna minkum man yuqatilu ala ta'awili al-Qur'an kama qataltu ala tanzili. He says, among you in this audience today, he says, there is someone among you who will fight for the true ta'wil and interpretation of the Quran the way I fought for the revelation of the Quran. So the Prophet is saying, when I
was receiving the Quran from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when the Tanzil was happening, Mushrikeen were opposing me, and I was fighting for the Tanzil of the Quran. Then he says, a time will come where Quran will be there, and there will be no problem of Mushrikeen anymore, but there will be Muslims who will challenge the interpretation of the Quran. And so now he says, the way I fought for the Tanzil of the Quran, there is somebody among you who will stand up and fight for the ta'wil, true interpretation of the Quran. And according to these narrations from the Sunni scholars, Abu Bakr stood up and he said, am I the one, Ya Rasulullah? And Rasulullah said, no. Then Umar ibn Khattab stood up. He said, Ya Rasulullah, am I the one you're referring to? And the Prophet says, no. I am referring to somebody who is repairing my sandal, pointing towards Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salatu wasalam.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The Derek Chauvin murder trial held closing arguments on Monday, 19th of April, before the jury began considering a verdict over the death of George Floyd that is anxiously awaited by millions of Americans. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Chris McGreal. The piece is titled Derek Chauvin Jury Begins Deliberations as America Braces for Verdict. Stay with us for more of Chris McGreal's article. Derek Chauvin murder trial heard closing arguments on Monday, 19th of April, before the jury began considering a verdict over the death of George Floyd that is anxiously awaited by millions of Americans. Tensions are running high in Minneapolis, with hundreds of National Guard soldiers deployed. Last year, video of the former police officer's alleged killing of George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, prompted days of protests, riots, and looting, and the demonstrations across the United States as well as the wider world. Protests flared up again earlier this month over the shooting of Daunte Wright, a 20-year-old black man, by police officers during a traffic stop in a Minneapolis suburb. Many Americans have reached their own verdict in the Derek Chauvin case and see the trial as part of a reckoning in the broader struggle for racial justice. Nonetheless, on Monday, 19th of April, 2021, lawyers focused on persuading the jury. Prosecutor Steve Schleicher said the key to the case lay in video footage of Derek Chauvin pressing his knee onto George Floyd's neck, even as he pleaded for his life, right to his very last words, "I can't breathe." "This case is exactly what you saw with your eyes. It's what you know in your heart," he said. Prosecutor Steve Schleicher said the video showed Derek Chauvin had a complete indifference to George Floyd. For 9 minutes and 29 seconds, George Floyd begged until he could beg no more, and the defendant continued this assault, he said. The prosecutor said Chauvin's ego, his pride, led him to keep his knee in place, even as bystanders pleaded with him to stop because he wasn't going to be told what to do. He was going to do what he wanted, how he wanted, for as long as he wanted, said Schleicher. This was not policing. It was unnecessary. It was gratuitous, and he did it on purpose. If the jury agrees that Derek Chauvin, a 45-year-old, did commit an assault as he pinned George Floyd to the ground, that will open the path to a conviction on the most serious charge of second-degree murder, which requires the former police officer to have committed a felony that led to death. "What the defendant did here was straight-up felony assault," said Schleicher, "that killed George Floyd." If the jury does not agree with Chauvin's use of force was criminal in itself, but showed reckless disregard for human life, it could still convict him of third-degree murder. Derek Chauvin also faces a manslaughter charge. In instructions to the jury, Judge Peter Cahill said Derek Chauvin was culpable if he took an action that caused George Floyd's death, even if other factors contributed to it. "That will help the prosecution because even if, as the defense claims, heart damage and drug use contributed to Floyd's death, Chauvin will still be guilty if the jury finds his actions set heart failure in motion." Prosecutor Schleicher derided defense claims that Derek Chauvin's actions were not the cause of George Floyd's death and that he succumbed to a heart condition, drug use, and even carbon monoxide poisoning from car exhaust. Prosecutor Schleicher asked if George Floyd would have died that day if he hadn't been pinned down by Derek Chauvin and scorned the idea that he chose that moment to die of heart disease. "Use your common sense, believe your eyes," he told the jurors. "Unreasonable force, pinning him to the ground, that's what killed him." Prosecutor Schleicher reminded the jury of testimony from medical experts who said the way Derek Chauvin and other police officers kept George Floyd pinned to the ground cut off his breathing and was the sole cause of his death. George Floyd struggled desperate to breathe to make enough room in his chest to breathe, but the force was too much, said Schleicher. Schleicher told the jurors they did not have to find that the defendant intended to cause harm or to violate the law in order to convict him of second-degree murder. "The only thing the state has to prove is that he intended to apply force to George Floyd on purpose," he said. Derek Chauvin's lawyer, Eric Nelson, focused on whether the police officer's actions were reasonable under the totality of circumstances, as George Floyd fought hard against getting into a squad car. "Someone can be compliant 1 second and then fight the next," he said. Defense lawyer Eric Nelson said it was reasonable for Derek Chauvin to believe George Floyd's pleas that he could not breathe were a ruse to avoid arrest. The lawyer dismissed the evidence of a medical expert that the moment Floyd's leg lashed out was evidence of a kind of brain damage due to lack of oxygen, as made with hindsight and a medical degree. "A reasonable police will interpret this as at least some form of minimal resistance," he said. A Eric Nelson portrayed Derek Chauvin as distracted by a crowd at the time of George Floyd took his last breath, saying he reached for his mace because he saw it as a threat. That changed Officer Chauvin's perception on what was happening, he said. Eric Nelson said the totality of the situation justified Derek Chauvin's actions and established his innocence. This was an authorized use of force, as unattractive as it may be, and this is reasonable doubt, he said. There is absolutely no evidence that Officer Chauvin intentionally or purposefully applied unlawful force. Nelson said it defied common sense for the prosecution to dismiss George Floyd's heart condition and drug use as causes of his death. But on rebuttal, the prosecution accused Eric Nelson of distorting the facts in claiming that the prosecution had to prove there were no other factors at play in George Floyd's death for Derek Chauvin to be found guilty. It said Nelson's claims defied common sense. The closing arguments unusually went on for much of the day on Monday, reflecting the complexities of the case and the widely differing interpretations of events. Jerry Blackwell, the Special Assistant Attorney General, who opened arguments for the prosecution 3 weeks ago, had the last word before the judge sent the jury out to deliberate. He told jurors that the case against Derek Chauvin was so simple that a child could understand it, which was why a 9-year-old bystander told the police officer to get off of George Floyd. Jerry Blackwell finished with an evocative line that went from the victim's medical condition to the police officer's character and emotion. He said to the jury, "You were told, for example, that Mr. Floyd died because his heart was too big, and now, having seen all of the evidence, having heard all of the evidence, you know the truth. And the truth of the matter is that the reason George Floyd is dead is because Derek Chauvin's heart was too small." Chauvin faces up to 40 years imprisonment. The 12 jurors will be sequestered until they reach a verdict or fail to agree on any of the charges. Deliberations will continue until 7 p.m. each day, but the judge said if a verdict is reached close to that time, it will not be revealed until the following day. The courthouse has been sealed off and is heavily guarded. Members of George Floyd's family said that after the trauma of the trial, they want it to be over. "We are ready to get this trial done," Tara Brown, George Floyd's cousin, told CNN. She added, "It was very difficult. There were times when we were literally broken to tears."
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
کم ببنده برای اینکه بتونه این ماه رو خیلی مراقب باشه، خیلی مراقب باشه. به خصوص
During the month of Ramadan, we have to be more careful about our surroundings. Besides not committing sins in this month, we must pay more attention to our close relatives and family members. The reason is that in this month, we are considered the guests of Allah, and the guest of Allah does not commit sins in any way. Sometimes fasting takes away our energy and we become angry. That's the moment we must take control of our anger and somehow manage it. In a story, we read that once a man who was new to his working office was told by one of his colleagues that try not to bother me during Ramadan because I lose my control soon. The new man told his colleague that he also loses his control soon during Ramadan because of decreasing blood sugar. They both sat down and thought that it's better for both of them to manage their anger during this month. In this way, they could stop committing sins and the working atmosphere becomes more peaceful. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.